I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
The Bush administration today reversed its stand on a deadline for Iraq disarmament, saying it would be willing to put off tomorrow's vote on the joint U.S.-British resolution until next week. Washington had previously been saying that Saddam Hussein must disarm by Monday or face military force. Joining us on the line is Maggie Farley. She's U.N. Bureau Chief for the L.A. Times, and she's in New York. Maggie, what's going on at the United Nations, first of all, and why this possible delay?
Well, the Security Council is in a state of total confusion. Instead of reaching the compromise that everybody had been working for, the British offer yesterday for Saddam Hussein to achieve six tests just threw everybody into total confusion. The French have rejected it already. The Russians say that it's a no-go, and they're back to the drawing board today at 3.
And the war of words between France and Britain seems particularly heated. Britain, by the way, was calling in that six-step plan for different benchmarks, including Saddam Hussein would be required to go on television and renounce in Arabic weapons of mass destruction.
And there were five other things: permission for 30 weapons inspectors to travel outside the country for interviews with inspectors, destruction of all their remaining anthrax and chemical and biological weapons, handing over any other things like drones, missiles that could be used to deliver weapons, and passing legislation saying that continuing development is a crime.
Well, as you said, France in particular and Germany as well, and obviously Iraq, have all dismissed the British plan. So what do you think is behind the U.S. administration decision to postpone the vote?
I think that they feel like they're so close, maybe just one vote away from all the benefits that international backing of military action against Iraq would bring, that they're willing to just push a little bit more. But I tell you, they are right at the end of their patience.
Given today's news, how soon do you think a Security Council vote will be taken?
I don't think the White House has much tolerance for any more negotiating beyond next week. They really wanted a vote Friday. Now it seems like the White House is preparing a trip for Bush to go lobby overseas somewhere, although they aren't saying where quite yet. So give a little time for Bush to do one-on-one with some prime minister or president somewhere, look him in the eye. And then they say if they have to, they'll take the veto and go on.
Well, it can't be helping Bush administration impatience that Saddam Hussein has reportedly given $260,000 to families of Palestinians killed in fighting in Israel, including families of suicide bombers. There was a banquet in Gaza, and the families received their $10,000 checks. By the way, how is Iraq reacting to the infighting on the Security Council?
Well, Iraq is just delighted. If you look at Foreign Minister Naji Sabri's comments, Naji Sabri said it's not up for discussion, even by other states of the Security Council. So they're just delighted that the Security Council can't agree.
You speak of U.S. impatience, but what is U.N. formality? What would the formality be before a vote?
One of the sponsors of the resolution has to give 24 hours notice before a vote. That gives all of the countries time to go back to their capitals and get their proper instructions. But when they walk in the chamber, it's very simple. They call for a yes, a no, and then they count the abstentions. Mm. It can only take a minute.
Maggie, thank you.
You're welcome.
Maggie Farley is UN Bureau Chief for the Los Angeles Times. She spoke to us from New York.
Halliburton, the Texas company once headed by Vice President Dick Cheney, has been awarded a contract by the Pentagon to protect and oversee oil fields in a post-war Iraq. Now, the vice president no longer works for Halliburton, of course. He left in 2000. But he still receives up to $1 million in deferred compensation. Critics say that's a conflict of interest. Halliburton is also one of five U.S. corporations bidding on a contract worth possibly $900 million to be awarded by the Bush administration to lead the effort to rebuild a post-war Iraq. Freelance reporter Robert Bryce has been following the story and joins us on the line from Austin, Texas. Hello, Robert Bryce.
Hi, Bill.
Thanks for joining us. Now, Mr. Bryce, what precisely legally would be the conflict of interest here, or is there no legal prohibition?
Well, I don't know that there's any legal prohibition here. I think it's just more of a matter of the appearance of this entire affair. when Cheney left Halliburton to run with George W. Bush, he sold his stock in Halliburton and left with about $35 million in stock options and so on that he'd sold. But the month that he was sworn into office, January of 2001, he signed a deal with Halliburton in which the company agreed to pay him some of his deferred compensation over the next five-year period. So for essentially the entire time that Mr. Cheney was going to be in office, he was going to be receiving regular checks from Halliburton as part of their deferred compensation plan.
Right. But are you suggesting that Halliburton Corporation should not be able to do any business with the U.S. government because a former CEO happens to be vice president?
Well, of course not. What I am saying, though, is that it just looks bad. Why wouldn't Mr. Cheney have just said, look, pay me out. Let's sever any ties that we have right now. And instead, I guess they just felt, well, no one is going to question this. This isn't going to be a problem. And sure, I can continue getting paychecks from you, even though I'm serving as the vice president of the United States. And I think it's clearly an error in judgment on the part of the vice president.
What do you think the consequences could be for Vice President Cheney and the Bush administration?
Throughout, I think the administration has had to answer questions about what is the justification for this war and who's going to profit and so on. And here now, they've just simply left themselves open for more criticism that this is not about the liberty of the Iraqis or about terrorism. This is about oil and it's about business.
Let's turn to the other possibility for Halliburton being part of that $900 million contract. $900 million, to put some perspective on it all, is more than double what the U.S. will spend in fiscal years 2002 to 2004 on rebuilding Afghanistan. What's at stake for a company like Halliburton?
Halliburton is already, you know, in a very good position to do some of the work in Iraq. It did a lot of the work in the oil fields in Kuwait after the 1991 Persian Gulf War, and it's already doing quite well in terms of military contracts with the Pentagon. It has multi-million dollar contracts with the Pentagon to manage the bases in Guantanamo Bay, and it's also providing many of the food services for the military that are based in Afghanistan. So, you know, I think from the point of view of Halliburton and Brown and Root, you know, they're simply trying to get as many military contracts as they can. It's part of their business.
However bad it all may look to some, do you expect Vice President Cheney to change anything?
Well, I think were he smart, he would. He would go to Halliburton and say, let's, you know, go ahead and pay me out. Let's make this relationship formalized and end it now. Give me the deferred compensation that I'm owed now so that I'm not still receiving paychecks from you while I'm serving as vice president.
Robert Bryce, thank you very much for speaking with us.
Thank you, Bill.
Robert Bryce is a freelance reporter and author of the book Pipe Dreams, Greed, Ego, Jealousy, and the Death of Enron. He spoke to us from Austin, Texas.
Well, U.S. military planners have been questioned about the consequences of war with Iraq. They're also planning for consequence management. It's a new phrase in military circles since 9/11. It means responding quickly to the use of weapons of mass destruction. Consequence management teams are active in the U.S. and in Kuwait. Joining us on the line is Brigadier General Cornell Wilson. He's the commander of the Combined Joint Task Force for Consequence Management in Kuwait. It's a force of 700 U.S., Czech, Slovak, and German troops. And General Wilson, welcome.
Hello, how are you?
I'm just fine. Well, we're intrigued. What exactly does your task force do?
Our task force was set up back in November of 2001 to respond to weapons of mass destruction incidents. That means if somebody has a chemical agent, biological agent, or high field explosive, we respond to requests from the host nation if they do get what we call slimed.
You call it slimed, getting slimed?
Yes.
As in Ghostbusters.
Yes. Yeah. Not quite Ghostbusters, right. But it's an affectionate term all military folks use.
Yeah. I know the Kuwaiti government has been running television ads, letting people know that there are chemical detection patrols. They've been getting people accustomed to the sound of warning sirens, even sending out text messages to cell phone users, you know, with instructions on how to respond to some sort of chemical attack. We've seen pictures from Israel of drills where there are hundreds of hospital beds set up in parking lots with portable shower stalls. You know, the idea being that people would be quickly showered in some sort of attack. Is that the kind of planning that you would have?
My plan is a little more definitive in that we have specialized units to decontaminate people and vehicles. My organization for the vehicles have a kind of like a car wash set up, so that they can decontaminate the vehicles. They run them through the vehicles on decontamination stations, and it's a pretty sophisticated operation.
Yeah. I understand you're going to have a drill today?
Yes, we just completed the drill. It was with the Kuwaitis.
What'd you do?
Well, we simulated a mustard gas attack on an area that was like a fairgrounds where there were a number of people walking around, and the first responders were the Kuwaiti civil defense folks, and they then saw that it was going to be a pretty big task. They called us in, and we set up our command post right near theirs and started cooperating with them to ensure we can get the right equipment in there and start decontaminating people and vehicles and trying to get the right process set up to get the people back to the hospital.
How are the Kuwaitis responding to all of this? I would think this would be nerve-wracking.
The feedback I get is that they're prepared for whatever, and they're leaning forward, as we always like to say, in the foxhole.
What's that phrase?
Leaning forward in the foxhole.
Leaning forward.
You're getting ready to launch into the attack from the foxhole, and really anticipating what's going to happen, so you're ready to go and take off and do what you have to do.
Well, General Wilson, your unit could probably help the press a little bit. I understand that the press that's waiting to be embedded with the troops was at a hotel the other day, and an Army person ran in and did a surprise drill with them and yelled, "Gas, gas." They were all lounging around the pool, and none of them knew how to put their gas masks on.
The first time you try that, it's kind of a challenging task, but the more you practice, the better off you'll be.
Well, General Wilson, thank you so much for telling us about it.
Well, my pleasure. Mm-hmm. You know, one last thing is that I'm just really proud of the young men and women I have here. They are just outstanding, superb young folks, well-trained, motivated, and very smart. And I just want to say that the American folks have a great team over here.
Well, General Wilson, I hope you never have to use your skills.
I feel the same way.
Brigadier General Cornell Wilson is the commander of the Combined Joint Task Force for Consequence Management in Kuwait. General, thank you.
You're welcome.
And this note. Scientists say they found the oldest footprints of Stone Age ancestors of modern humans. Three sets of footprints made by three of our relatives, believed to have been fleeing a volcano north of Naples 325,000 to 350,000 years ago. There's poignancy, I think, somehow, to imagine this trio running for their lives, terrified, in a world gone mad. Their vulnerability is still in us. Their struggle 350,000 years ago is in some way related to ours. Somehow, it's something that happened in the family. Or was it in the family? Strict creationists believe the human race is only about 4,000 years old. And that's hardly a fringe opinion. A Gallup poll shows that 48% of Americans believe in creationism, very nearly half. President Bush himself has said he believes the jury is still out on evolution. Yet, those footprints.
Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now.
Walking in your footsteps. Walking in your footsteps.
From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. For more on the power plays at the United Nations still debating the deadline for war with Iraq, go to WBUR.org and click on news. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Alpine Environmental, lead paint abatement professionals working to make homes safer and healthier for homeowners and their children. AlpineEnvironmentalInc.com. Portland Pottery Supply, offering a full line of pottery materials, equipment, and supplies for schools, hobbyists, and professionals, now located in Braintree, PortlandPottery.com. And TechFusion.com, a local IT company providing on-site network and hardware support for small and large companies for the last 16 years. TechFusion.com, where data is never lost. Revising the accumulation predictions downward, now 1 to 3 inches in the greater Boston area, though the commute will be slick, according to the National Weather Service. Right now it's snowing and 34 degrees at 1221.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
Al-Samud missiles, torture chambers, an impoverished economy. That's what many Americans think of when they think of Iraq. But what about the creation of the alphabet, a system of banking, the discovery of algebra, all part of the rich history of the land now called Iraq? And even in modern times, the Arab world looked up to the Iraqi people as the most cultured among them, until Saddam Hussein's disastrous rule. While this history may be lost to many, it has a profound impact on how Iraqis see themselves today and in a post-Saddam world. Fawaz Jurjiz is a professor of history at Sarah Lawrence College. He joins us from Bronxville, New York, to talk about this incredible history. Good afternoon and welcome back, Professor.
My pleasure.
Well, you know, I found myself immersed in 3000 BC reading about this real incredible landmass that has become Iraq.
Well, as you said, it's really sad that in the minds of many Americans, Iraq and the Iraqis have become synonymous with Saddam Hussein. Yet, this cradle of civilization was the birthplace of communities that have moved us from prehistory to history.
Right.
In fact, about 400 BC, not just 300 BC, an advanced civilization was called the Sumerian culture. It flourished in this region long before that of Egypt, or Greece, or Rome. The Sumerians developed a mass system which is the basis of time in the modern world.
Right. It was the first math system based on the number 60. They also believed in private property, invented the wheel, the first plow.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And great poetry and epic literature were produced, the most famous, of course, of which is that has survived intact is the Epic of Gilgamesh, around 2700 BC. One can go on to talk about the Muslim conquest, which made present Iraq a central place, central focus of Islamic learning and power.
But unfortunately, we can't go on because of time. I mean, the history is that long and deep, and it involves the Babylonians and the Kassites, the Assyrians, who also made great strides in math and science as different peoples came through the area, names like Nebuchadnezzar. But it became an area known for warfare and conflict.
Absolutely. What we need to remember is that modern-day Iraq was created in the 1920s by Britain. That is, since its creation by colonial Britain in the 1920s after the defeat of the Ottoman Empire in World War I, the Ottoman Empire fought on the side of Germany, Iraq has not been able to evolve into a stable political culture.
Are you saying then that if the country had been allowed to function as what? I mean, we had to remind people that when the Ottoman Empire fell after World War I, the area was split up by the League of Nations. And Britain, as you said, established an Arab government, some say because of British interest in Iraqi oil fields, and they wanted to build a transcontinental railroad from Europe across Turkey.
Absolutely. But not only the making and the remaking of the modern Middle East in the aftermath of World War I, that's after the defeat of the Ottoman Empire, was really based on what you might say the colonial interest of Britain and France.
But, Professor, tell me, because as far back as 634 A.D., when an army of Arab Muslims invaded, there were so many invasions, but the first battle of the Muslims, known as the Battle of the Chains, they overtook the Persian soldiers. There have been battles over this land. So what else is at play here?
Well, I mean, unfortunately, it seems to me that military power goes hand in hand with great civilizational achievements. I think it would be very misleading to focus on the military aspect and ignore the great civilizational dimension of present-day Iraq.
Well, let's do that, and let's bring ourselves up to closer to present-day. 1979, the then-president was replaced by Saddam Hussein, his vice president. What happened under his rule that affected that great civilization that you're talking about?
Well, I think this is a very good point, because since the 1958 advent of army rule, successive regimes have terrorized Iraqis into submission and bled the country dry with their military adventures. And unfortunately, the building blocks and institutions necessary for a functioning polity, let alone a democracy, do not exist today in today's Iraq. In fact, civil society has been crushed and the middle class weakened.
Is there any middle class or intellectual class left, or describe it for us?
Well, I want to say a few words because, I mean, it's quite fascinating how this man, that is Saddam Hussein, with very humble background and little education, was able to overcome great hurdles and capture power and consolidate his rule in the last 25 years. I think it would be very misleading, again, to explain Hussein's rise to power and his durability by focusing on what I call the use of coercion. Yes, Saddam Hussein has used blood and iron to silence opposition, but he also used oil resources and tribal means to keep the majority of the population relatively, of course, content. In fact, we tend to forget that by the late 1970s, the Baathists, who are the ruling party in Iraq, despite their autocratic and ruthless ways, succeeded in creating the largest middle class in the Arab world. But of course, the economic sanctions have turned the social structure upside down. In fact, I would argue that Iraq now is under a double pressure from both the international community and the bloody tyranny in Baghdad. It's a double occupation. It's a double squeeze. And really, there little remains of the old, sophisticated Iraq, the capital of cultural production, the capital of Levantine capitalism. Iraq now is a shadow of its former self.
And so, briefly, Professor, the future does not look very good, either way.
Well, Iraq, unfortunately, has a long way to go. And the, I think, dominant narrative in Washington sounds more like a fairy tale because it does not take into account the complexity of the task ahead in Iraq. I mean, while the rhetoric of bringing democracy into Iraq is very much reassuring, the reality on the ground is very complex and very frightening.
Well, Professor, it is such a fascinating history. We can only touch on it here, and it sounds like a precarious future. Thank you so much for spending some time with us.
It's my pleasure.
Fawaz Jirjiz, professor of history at Sarah Lawrence College. His most recent book is called America and Political Islam, Clash of Cultures, Clash of Interest.
Tomorrow on Here and Now, we speak with a human shield, a former Gulf War veteran who was willing to place himself between the Iraqi and American bombs until a fallout with Saddam Hussein's regime.
And a review of the latest film to be set in the American suburbs, The Safety of Objects. That's tomorrow.
Stay with us. There's more ahead here and now.
From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. Coming up on Fresh Air at 1 o'clock, Eisenhower, the CIA, and the hidden story of America's space espionage with journalist Philip Taubman. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by the Builder Charitable Public Health Trust, supporting the coverage of disease prevention and control. Surface Works of Watertown and Concord, a professional cleaning service because it's nice to come home to a clean house. On the web at surfaceworksinc.com. And the European Watch Company, where timepieces may become heirlooms for the next generation. A distinctive collection of fine watches available at their Newbury Street Gallery or on the web at europeanwatch.com. Meet Scott Simon and learn more about our next Citizens of the World tour to Africa at a free reception tonight. Seating is limited. To reserve your space, call 800-909-9287. 32 degrees and light snow in Boston at 12:30.
This is Bob Oakes. Tomorrow on Morning Edition, the latest on the UN debate on Iraq, plus a report on the situation in the Kurdish area of Turkey on the border of Iraq. We'll also have a report on the controversy over farm-raised fish. Those stories and all the news tomorrow on Morning Edition, starting at 5, here on WBUR, Boston's NPR news station.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, proudly supporting public radio and serving the community on the web at MathWorks.com.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
Coming up, Salt Lake City reacts to the return of Elizabeth Smart.
And the Senate votes yes this morning on a bill that would ban so-called partial birth abortions.
Plus, listeners' war poetry, from those who remember wars past to those much younger.
May the war be like no other, and before it even begins, may we make peace with others and agree that everyone wins.
These stories coming up, Here and Now.
I'm Ted O'Brien. The diplomatic turmoil surrounding Iraq continues at the United Nations. France is rejecting a British compromise on efforts to disarm Saddam Hussein, and that has prompted the U.S. to consider postponing a vote on an ultimatum against Iraq until next week. The British plan lists six disarmament requirements that Iraq would have to meet or else face, quote, serious consequences. The UN Security Council meets again this afternoon to consider the Iraq question. In the meantime, Secretary of State Colin Powell is disputing claims that Israel drives the White House Mideast policy. Powell told a House panel that Israel is an important ally, but decisions are based on U.S. interests.
This is a policy that was developed over two administrations over many years, and it remains our policy today. It is driven by our own national interests. It is driven by us trying to help the United Nations do its job. It is driven by our concern for the people of Iraq.
Powell also pointed to other allies in the region, including Saudi Arabia and Egypt. An Arab delegation has postponed a trip to Baghdad scheduled for this weekend as another effort to head off war in Iraq stalls. The Arab League says that Iraqi officials requested the delay, which they said was negative and ill-timed. Iraqi's foreign minister says the meeting was put off because his government wants to make sure the diplomats are able to meet with top Iraqi officials. Ireland's leader is visiting the White House in the annual St. Patrick's Day ceremony. Prime Minister Bertie Ahern presented President Bush with a bowl of shamrocks and offered support for U.S. plans to invade Iraq. Ahern says the United Nations was designed to face regimes such as Saddam Hussein's. Legislation banning a procedure that some critics call partial birth abortion has passed the Senate. Opponents to the bill fear the measure could lead to a larger assault on women's abortion rights. The bill prohibits doctors from committing an overt act designed to kill a partially delivered fetus and includes an exemption for cases in which the procedure is necessary to save the life of the mother, but not when her health is in danger. President Bush is hailing the move. The measure now goes to the House. Retail sales dropped in February as war worries and snowstorms kept consumers away, the worst showing for industry in 15 months. On the other hand, the Dow is up 150 points at this hour. The Nasdaq is up 29 points. It's 33 minutes past the hour. You're listening to Here and Now. We're funded by you, our listeners, and Corey McPherson Nash, a design firm developing branding, print, and interactive communication solutions. Thoughtful design embedded in creative strategy. CMNDesign.com. And Coco Budakian and Sons, committed to educating consumers on the purchase, restoration, and cleaning of all types of Oriental rugs. In Winchester and at KOKORugs.com. And Dana-Farber Partners Cancer Care, a collaboration among Mass General Hospital, Dana-Farber Cancer Institute, and Brigham and Women's Hospital working together to fight adult cancer. CancerCare.Harvard.edu. Revised forecast once again for this afternoon. Revised downward as far as snow accumulation is concerned. Now 1 to 3 inches of snow with temperatures slowly falling to around 30. Tonight will be clear by early in the evening. Colder with lows of 15 to 20. Tomorrow mostly sunny and continued cold with highs in the lower 30s. It's snowing and 32 degrees at 12:35. This is WBUR.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
Family and friends of Elizabeth Smart are still reacting to her return. Elizabeth was abducted 9 months ago from the Salt Lake City bedroom she shared with her younger sister. She was found yesterday walking with Brian Mitchell and his companion, Wanda Barzi, just 15 miles away in Sandy, Utah. Mitchell had worked one day as a handyman at the Smart home. He was spotted by a woman and another couple who had seen his picture on TV's America's Most Wanted. Well, joining us on the line is Salt Lake City's Deseret News reporter, Pat Reavy. And Pat, Salt Lake must be just in shock over this.
I think both in shock and really a celebration type of mode. Banners, balloons, ribbons. Everybody is just extremely happy, and I think also just shocked that it ended this way. Nobody expected this outcome.
Well, and puzzled. You know, a lot of people are asking, how could Elizabeth have been walking with this man? Apparently, we now hear the Seattle Times reporting that they were stopped several times in California, and she gave a false name. And people have come forward with pictures of her with him at parties in the area. Of course, she was wearing a veil, but how is it that she wasn't seen sooner?
I don't know. It's one of the mysteries, especially since they stick out so much, and I think that's ultimately what led to their arrest. He had a long beard. They were dress, the description used mostly is transient-looking people. They were carrying sleeping bags. They were carrying most of their possessions with them in, like, garbage bags. The women were dressed in kind of a burqa, kind of like a veil. Only Elizabeth's eyes were showing, I guess, a dress that went down just past her knees. It was whitish. And they really, I guess, would stick out, especially in Sandy, Utah, which is more an affluent neighborhood, I guess.
Yeah. How did police even come up with the sketch of Mitchell? Because they'd been focusing on another handyman, Richard Reese, who since died.
It was several months after the kidnapping that Mary Catherine just really almost out of the blue one day and came up to her parents and said, I think I know who it is. I think I know who that man was. And that's when Mitchell's name came up again. At the time, he was only known as Emmanuel. That was a name that he used at the time. Remember, the smarts found him from panhandling on the streets of Salt Lake City. He was a self-proclaimed prophet to preach to the homeless. And Mary Catherine stepped forward, and finally the dad went to police. They did a sketch artist drawing. It did get on America's Most Wanted, and that's when family members, stepsons, stepdaughters of Mitchell saw him and said, that's him, and yes, he would fit the profile of a person who would do this.
Yeah, the children of Wanda Barzee, Mitchell's companion, came forward and helped everyone track them down. As recently as this past week, Elizabeth's uncle, Tom Smart, has been very critical of the police investigation in the papers.
The Smarts have been very passionate about finding Elizabeth, which I think is obvious through their consistency of holding news conference for months and months at a time. We were out there in the summer last year when it was 100 degrees. We were out there in the snow. Tom Smart, especially the past few weeks, I know he's been doing his own investigating. He's been going back, re-interviewing some of the people involved in the case, some of the witnesses. He felt very, very strongly that police were not putting enough time and effort into Mitchell. So I guess it's fair to say in the past few weeks there was growing tension between the family. They tried to not air it publicly. It finally hit the papers just yesterday. But the fallout from all of this is yet to see. There's a report that today that our mayor is behind closed doors with the city attorney talking about that very issue.
There was a couple and another woman who recognized Mitchell on the street from his picture on America's Most Wanted. The couple was at Kinko's making the resume for the man who was out of a job. Does he have a job now?
I don't know, but hopefully he'll get to collect that reward money, which is well-deserved, and that might help him out for a little bit.
Well, Pat, thank you.
Okay.
Pat Reavy is a reporter for Salt Lake City's Deseret News.
The Senate voted by a large margin this morning to pass a bill that would ban so-called partial birth abortions. Under the new provisions, doctors who perform this type of late-term abortion would face fines and up to 2 years in prison. Today's vote comes after the Senate earlier killed Democratic-sponsored amendments to the bill that would have created exceptions to protect the health of the mother and increase the availability of contraceptives. President Bush commended the Senate's action. Mark Preston is a staff writer with Roll Call, the Capitol Hill newspaper. He joins us from Capitol Hill. Hello, Mark.
Hey, how are you?
Mark, what are the chances this bill will become law?
I think they're very good chances. As you have stated, the president immediately sent out a news release just saying that, you know, he's very happy that this has happened. I just spoke to somebody over in the House of Representatives, a Republican official over there. They said that this is going to be one of their top priorities, which we should not be surprised about. Could see the House take up the issue within the next 6 weeks or so. However, you know, while I do think this could become law, there is going to be some kind of a court challenge to it. Barbara Boxer, a Democrat from California, has already said that it's unconstitutional. The pro-abortion rights groups say that it's unconstitutional. So I think that it's still going to be on the radar screen, and we could see it in the courts. But this was a big victory for people who want to ban the procedure.
Well, you know, Mark, speaking of the courts, 2 years ago, the Supreme Court struck down a similar Nebraska law. But presumably Republican lawmakers think they've come up with a bill that will be constitutional this time. What's different?
Well, you know, I'm not necessarily sure what's different, but what's interesting is that you saw some momentum today, at least on this issue. You know, the vote was 64-33. You know, that's 14 more than would needed, you know, in what is a 100-member Senate for a halfway point. And you had some pretty prominent Democrats who agreed that this procedure should be outlawed, including Senate Minority Leader Tom Daschle and one of his top lieutenants, Senator Byron Dorgan. They are two of the guys that helped guide the ship for Democrats here in the Senate, and they voted to outlaw it. I don't know what will happen in the courts, but it is pretty interesting. What a pro-abortion rights activist will be able to find some kind of a silver lining in all this, however, is that there was a sense of the Senate resolution that did pass last night. Basically, this is non-binding, but it basically is supposed to express what the Senate is thinking or what they believe. And basically, what that resolution said last night is that Roe v. Wade, you know, the big abortion law, should not be overturned.
Well, critics of the bill, of course, warn that we have now stepped upon a slippery slope, that Republican lawmakers will use the bill to begin the banning process of other kinds of abortion. What do you think?
Well, there's no question that this opens the door, but, you know, let's take it one step further and say, I'm sure we're going to see the Democrats who are running for president, you know, some of them are going to use this issue to try to beat back, you know, against President Bush and Republican lawmakers. This is certainly an issue that riles up the masses. It certainly gets the activists on both sides engaged, so to speak. So I think this issue is going to become a big issue over the next year and a half, no doubt.
Despite Iraq, things still can get done in Washington?
Very little. Very little. You know, we're just kind of waiting to see what happens with this war in Iraq. We actually had thought it would have occurred at this point. It keeps getting delayed. But there's very little getting done here in Washington.
Mark, thanks very much.
Okay, take care.
Mark Preston is a staff writer for Roll Call, the Capitol Hill newspaper. We talked to him from Capitol Hill.
Still to come, listeners respond to our invitation to pen poetry about a pending war with Iraq.
You're listening to Here and Now.
It's Thursday when we open up the Here and Now mailbag and air some of your thoughts.
Well, Robin, Neil Clark of Arlington, Massachusetts, sent this email regarding our story about a woman who became stranded and died after driving at a National Monument park in her SUV. The couple was woefully unprepared, Neil writes, but the automobile manufacturers who promote their supposedly earth-conquering products are culpable, too. I have had a four-wheel drive vehicle for over 20 years now, and I know it's not like in the movies, but many people don't, having been fed go-anywhere images on television for years.
Well, most of the mail we received this week was on one topic, France, or rather, French fries, which listener Jay Potter points out aren't even French, they're from Belgium. We're going to stay on this topic because it seems we touched a collective nerve when talking to Republican North Carolina Congressman Walter Jones, who pushed for the removal of the word French from French fries and French toast, anything French, on the House cafeteria menu. The change is a protest of France's refusal to back the U.S. on its Iraq policy.
Well, Jane Seagully of Natick, Massachusetts, has this response. While I appreciate the congressman's attempt to be, quote, lighthearted, I was disturbed by the childishness of snubbing another country because it fails to fall in line with the American way of thinking. Mature individuals respect differences of opinion rather than discount them out of hand.
And there were many voicemails, this one from Julie Rogers in Eugene, Oregon.
We see French flags being flown at our peace rallies here. And the French citizens who have become American citizens that I know are feeling intensely proud of their country. We got our inspiration from their philosophers for our revolution. Our revolution gave them inspiration for their revolution. They have been with us off and on throughout our history. We are them. They are us.
In addition to the cafeteria snub, we pointed out other insults hurled at the French, including one on the Simpsons TV show, and we asked if they weren't unfair. But Congressman Jones said the French should support the U.S. position on Iraq because of the 3,000 lives lost in the World Trade Center attack. Robert Schneider of Lexington, Mass. Fired this off. Why do you fail to point out to Senator Jones that Iraq had nothing to do with the terrorist attacks of 9/11?
Jeff from Chelmsford, Massachusetts, added, when one stops to realize the tremendous breach of responsibility that Congress exercised in forfeiting its responsibility to make or stop war and its current inability to effect positive change in our disastrous economy, it's reprehensible to think that our elected representatives are spending their time renaming fast foods as a political statement.
And as other listeners pointed out, in the House cafeteria on their tax dollars. Well, the French fracas aside, listener Peter Korzanewski writes, "Thank you so much for your piece on Johnny Cash. It brought tears to my eyes and put a lump in my throat." Merci, Pierre.
And as always, we do love to hear your thoughts. Our email address is letters@here-now.org. That's letters@here-now.org.
Or you can give us a call and leave a message at 617-358-0397. That's 617-358-0397. Please include your phone number, town, and your name.
Stay with us. There's more ahead here and now.
My sweetest friend, everyone I know goes away in the end, and you could have it all. My empire of dirt, I will let you down. I will make you hurt.
From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. Coming up on Talk of the Nation at 2 in the first hour, a reading list on the history of the Middle East region, including Iraq. In the second hour, smokers versus non-smokers. We're funded by your listeners and by Delta Dental, founder of the Massachusetts Delta Dental Foundation, finding new ways to combat the lack of affordable and accessible dental care in Massachusetts. 1-800-DELTA-US. The New England Spring Flower Show, showcasing more than 2 million flowers at Boston's Bayside Expo Center, March 15th through the 23rd. Advance tickets available at Shaw's Supermarket and Star Market and Borders. And ColorTech, photographic and digital processing services for the imaging consumers at Campus Camera in Kenmore Square, 727 Atlantic Avenue and 290 Main Street in Kendall Square. Now's your chance to make a contribution that will enter your name in a drawing to win a brand new Apple iBook laptop computer, courtesy of Tech Superpowers. Go to WBUR.org, and thanks.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
Homer, John Milton, Alfred Lord Tennyson, Shakespeare, all poets who wrote about war, sometimes describing its horrors, sometimes finding reasons to call it glorious. Well, these immortals are not alone. A few weeks ago, our roving poets, Molly Sicardo and Jim Burley, came by with an invitation for listeners to send us their poems of war. And did they ever? We received almost 200 submissions, and Jim and Molly are now back in the studio to share some of the pieces. Hello, Jim and Molly.
Hi.
Bill, nice to see you.
Yeah. See you. Jim, what a response. Did that surprise you?
Well, I think it's very much in the news and on people's minds, and so in that way, I think we're feeding to something that people want to talk about and talk about either through the poets they love or in their own poetry. Just a tremendous outpouring of stuff, though. I don't think we've ever gotten this many poems.
No, I don't think so either. And it was all types of people. It was mothers writing. It was former soldiers writing. It was current soldiers writing. We had a number of people. Diana Abruzzo comes to mind, who said, "I've never written a poem before. I had to write this." A lot of people just said, "I had to do this."
Molly, we want to get to as many as we can. Tell me about a favorite of yours.
This is one from Suzanne Winchester from Grantham, New Hampshire, "Soldiers Made." What are soldiers made of? Made of? What are soldiers made of? A baby's laugh his mother remembers, a heavy school bag from a recent September, a rented tux from a high school dance, son, friend, neighbor, now warrior at a second glance. And it goes on, what are soldiers made of? They're people.
Yeah. It hit a human chord, this request for submissions of war poetry, Jim?
I think so. And people sent us stuff that they didn't necessarily just write. They sent something that they'd written before or during the first Gulf War. This is from Barbara Helfgott Hyatt. She's a great poet from Cambridge, Massachusetts. I'm sitting in my Jeep someplace listening to the radio, and the commentator is saying, "There are just a few skirmishes now. The war is about to end," when another Jeep goes by with a young boy on it, most of his stomach blown away. He was still alive. I could tell. Just a lot of really charged work from really all over the country we get to submissions.
And Jim, you said many pulled this from their insides, not just from the present, but from the past. I spoke with John Cook of Wilmington, North Carolina. He was 28 years old when he served as a helicopter pilot in the 68th Assault Helicopter Company during the Vietnam War. So he definitely saw a lot of action. I asked him how present his experience was to him now, some 30 years later.
it's always close to me, you know, because I lost some good friends. And as a matter of fact, I recently wrote a book about it and had to self-publish it. But that book helped me sort of put everything in its place, if you know what I mean.
Yeah. We were very struck by your poem, Grease the Skids, because it had both a real sense of the military in it, at the same time, a real sense of what it is to be a soldier who's just missing a sweetheart. Could you read us that poem?
I'd be happy to. And I wrote this poem many years after the war, of course, and I would dedicate it to my wife, my sweet wife, Astrid. Okay, the poem is entitled Grease the Skids. There's a term that old helicopter pilots use. Grease the skids, they say, when they wish to land safely and move on without delay. Grease the skids, it means something like to ease, to assist, to advance, to expedite, to dispatch, not to agitate, not to aggravate, nor inebriate, but to facilitate. And so now I say to you, my darling, you have facilitated for me a smooth, soft, safe landing. Thank you, sweetheart, for looking out after our rations, our passions, our pets and our kids, and above all, for greasing my skids.
Mm.
How's that sound?
That sounds beautiful, John. What do you see as the link between an experience of war and poetry?
Well, I think the experience of war really speaks to your inner being. You know, it cuts as deeply as anything can. And when anyone writes poetry, I think that's what they're trying to do, is speak from the soul. You know, to give eloquence to those deepest feelings that they have.
Well, thanks for your poem that managed to marry a helicopter and how it lands and the heart of a young soldier missing a sweetheart back home. Thanks, John.
Well, that was my pleasure, Bill. Thank you.
That was a terrific poem by John Cook. We got a couple of pieces from Vietnam vets, one from Wolfgang P. May that talks about the war around us and what war is. It's not the fighting and it's not the dying. It's the death of love, the end of hope. Just a really touching piece.
How important is it to get the history of the people who've actually been through it? So the poem is recording the history of feelings as well as the history of the facts.
Yeah, every poem is kind of a map of the soul, isn't it? Whether it's an elderly man now remembering 30 years ago or a child. We received a surprising number of submissions from children. From Central High School in Phoenix, Arizona, received quite a few. I also spoke with 10-year-old Jackson Sabag of Salem, Massachusetts. Jackson goes to the Saltonstall School. His teacher's name is Lee Sloss. And his mother, Claire, sent us his poem after she discovered it among his homework assignments.
We were asked to write a poem on how we wanted to change the world in the same format as John Marsden did when he wrote A Prayer for the 21st Century, which is basically starting every sentence with the word may.
Well, Jackson, why don't you read me your poem?
Okay. May the ripples and waves flow freely. May the birds soar as they do. May the flowers blossom in the springtime and be mounted with droplets of dew. May our family show us what we need. May our peers show us what we know. May the true love beneath our hearts forever or once more show. May the war be like no other, and before it even begins, may we make peace with others and agree that everyone wins. May we care for all black females. May we respect all white men. It's been nearly forever that we've been at it. Let's stop and not start again.
Jackson, how does all this talk of war make you feel?
Well, actually, it makes me feel kind of funny inside, because we have feuds here at home, but it always works out, and I think it just should be that way with our countries. I mean, like, we should just try and talk it over. And if I could ask the Lord one question, it would probably have to be, why is different bad?
Jackson, just tell me one more thing. Did it kind of help you? Did it kind of make you feel better to write this poem?
I actually see my poem as, like, a message to people, like, declaring war. Because when my mom read it, she thought it was really good. and she wanted to send it to all these people and even George Bush. And I did think of it as a message towards him. So it's kind of like I'm saying all the good things that could come out of not having war.
Jackson Sabag, thank you very much for talking to us.
You're welcome.
Wow. What an intuitive child. That is wonderful.
This is another one I do want to mention. It's by Marilyn Hertenstein, and it's very short. War, no more.
We've had songs of innocence and experience. One poem that struck me, I'll read briefly from a passage of it. It's called Sacrifice. It kind of links innocence and experience. It's a mother writing about her child newly born. I see neither your secret rivers nor my own reflection there, nothing but the wrinkles on your forehead. I smooth them, want them to go away. You would be the tow-headed boy with sturdy legs. I send you off to do the killing now, to fumble over corpses of mothers, to toss babies away. That's Sandy Weissman from Boston, Massachusetts.
Wow.
This one sent in by John Lippincott is a short one called To Crete. On the wind, sand, goat bells and flies. Always the flies, the feasting flies.
Well, and I know we're going to put all the poems that we got in on the website.
We certainly are. We're going to post a few poems also from Jackson's classmates at the Saltonstall School on our website. As you say, Jim, in addition to all the submissions from our poetic listeners, to check them out, please visit us at here-now.org. That's HERENOW.org. Thank you all so much for your thoughtful and moving submissions. Molly, what's up for the next challenge?
Well, we got so many people that wrote into this, and obviously poetry and art is something that's very important to people, so we were going to honor artists.
Artists. Wonderful. We'll look forward to that. Here and Now's roving poets, Molly Sicardo and Jim Burley.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
Get into your radio.
And join us again. Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software. Information on the web at mathworks.com.
This is
.com.
This is